Sure.
Sure. That'll work.
Sure.
Okay. Here we are. The third session, an integral part of the war effort, POWs and military strategy. And our first speaker is Earl Hess, who holds the Stuart W. McClellan Chair in History at Lincoln Memorial History. And he is the author of 23 books and 30 articles, and thus perhaps needs no introduction. So, sorry. I'm going to talk, and I'm going to introduce all of you at once. But I will say that his most recent book, The Battle of Ezra Church and the Struggle for Atlanta, was published by UNC Press in 2015. And I think I know the reason why you can do this, Earl. It's because you have an undergraduate degree in American Studies, which I never would have guessed, but you learn these things from, you know, reading people's CVs. And today he will speak on Blue or Gray, Taking Advantage of the Civil War Prisoner System. Now, Daniel Farrell is a doctoral candidate at the Department of History in Kent State University. His dissertation research focuses on civilian prisoners of war and how military prisons were used by the Union during the war to circumvent judicial norms. And I will say that in what is perhaps a sideline interest, Daniel has a forthcoming book chapter entitled History Without a Capital H, Violence, Commodification, and the Perpetuation of the Postmodern Condition in Django Unchained. Like I said, the things you learn about people. And finally, we have Derek Mallett, who is an associate professor in the Department of Military History at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. He is the author of Hitler's Generals in America, Nazi POWs and Allied Military Intelligence, published by the University of Kentucky Press. And his paper today is P.O. Box 1142. Fort Hunt, Virginia, and the American Interrogation of World War II Prisoners of War. So, gentlemen, Earl, thank you.
Thank you, Leanne, very much for that introduction. Thank you to everybody, Lorian, Dan, Leanne, everybody involved in creating this unique and fascinating symposium, everybody who's attending. I'm enjoying it. The prisoner system was the venue for the most intense interaction between the opposing belligerents of the Civil War. It was a place where the blue and gray met and argued and compromised with each other to decide the fate of hundreds of thousands of men. We take it for granted that this interaction proceeded along visible, acknowledged lines, that there was a protocol for how men were handled so that they could wind up fighting on the correct side once again. But I tell you, in years of reading Civil War primary documents, it's clear that many soldiers North and South bypassed the protocol to take advantage of the prisoner system for their own purpose. They employed devious or obscure lines of action. They confounded the expectations of their contemporaries and of latter-day historians about their motive, their objective, and their allegiance. Many men in gray wound up in blue, and vice versa. Others deserted to the enemy and then later managed to rejoin their original army and act as if nothing had happened. Civil War soldiers, in other words, realized they had a good deal of latitude to play the prisoner system to accomplish their own ends that often had nothing to do with helping the army they fought for. In fact, they realized that individual soldiers have agency, the ability to promote private ends within a public system that was controlled by bureaucrats and in some ways was rather porous and unwieldy. Why and how they did so, I think, opens up a new door in the study of prisoners of war. And I'll briefly speak about three case studies to illustrate these themes and end my talk with some ideas about what we might be able to make of this phenomenon. Case study number one, the Fort Donelson prisoners. Federal authorities garnered their first major haul of Confederate prisoners when Ulysses S. Grant captured Fort Donelson on February 16, 1862, achieving the first major strategic victory for the Union cause in the Civil War. He also captured 15,000 Confederate soldiers that day, and eventually sent them north to be incarcerated in camps located in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. Most of these Fort Donelson prisoners waited for several months, till about September or so of 62, until they could be processed through the exchange system that had already been worked out between North and South earlier in the war. But a vocal minority of those guys began to complain after a few weeks of captivity that they had been coerced into the Confederate Army, had no heart in the rebel cause, and wanted to be released from prison so they could avoid being returned to the South. Eventually, federal authorities decided to offer these men an opportunity to leave rebel service. They were invited to take an oath of allegiance to the U.S. government in order to avoid being repatriated. I have not been able to find out how many Fort Donelson prisoners took the oath of allegiance, but certainly several hundred did so. William Lewis McKay of the 18th Tennessee recalled years after the war that on August 11, 1862, notices were posted through the prison offering to all who wished to go home the privilege of taking the oath of allegiance to the U.S. government. McKay also recorded the names of 32 men of the 18th Tennessee who did take the oath. The rest of the prisoners were told to prepare to go south to be exchanged. They were transported from Springfield, Illinois, to Vicksburg, Mississippi, the designated place of exchange in the West, on September 22, 1862. Now, of the 32 men that McKay named as having taken the oath of allegiance, three have no service record in the 18th Tennessee. That leaves 29 men. The service records of all of them indicate that they did take the oath of allegiance. In fact, William M. Weatherly's service record contains the signed oath. 20 of the 29 men who took the oath have an enigmatic notation in their service record. Their names appear on a roster of Confederate prisoners sent to Vicksburg for exchange, and most of those notes indicate they did reach Vicksburg on September 23rd. It is unclear what this means. But more to our point, most tellingly, of the 29 men known to have taken the oath of allegiance to the U.S. government, 10 wound up serving once again in the Confederate Army within a few months of their taking the oath. William G. Moore was wounded, in fact, in Confederate uniform in the thigh at the Battle of Stones River on January 2, 1863, only 4 months after solemnly swearing to be loyal to the federal government. Eventually, he received a medical discharge and went home. Thomas Clifton was missing in action on the second day at Chickamauga, September 20th, 1863, and never heard from again. Just as interesting to me, of the 10 men who took the oath and then violated it by once again serving in the CS Army, 6 deserted the CS Army. William N. Weatherly deserted on January 15th, 1863, while William Pomeroy deserted August 1863, and another guy, Benjamin Thomas, joined a regiment in Nathan Bedford Forrest's Cavalry Brigade, but deserted in December of 62. Of the 29 oath takers in the 18th Tennessee, only one person, J.A. Williams, seemed to have fulfilled the expectations of federal authorities who hoped that the oath would deny a man to the Confederate Army and turn him into a peaceable citizen. What we have in Williams' service record is a note that after taking the oath of allegiance, he remained at home for the rest of the war. Now, I admit that Confederate service records are notorious. They're difficult to interpret because they tend to have too little information in them. But in this case, service records are about all we have to go on if we want to see what became of those 32 men in the 18th Tennessee who took the oath of allegiance. Their record is mixed and muddled and not easy to make sense of, but we can conclude one or two things with certainty. Number one, a large percentage of those men eventually changed their mind and rejoined the Confederate Army, violating that oath, confounding the hopes of federal authorities that oath-taking could become a method of dividing the loyal from the disloyal. Whether they intended to rejoin their comrades in gray from the beginning, whether they fully intended to trick Union authorities from the start, we don't know. But in the end, a good number of these turncoats turned their coat once again by deserting from the Confederate Army only a few months after rejoining it. Okay, case study number two, and Angela Riotto knows this, Captain John B. Jordan of the 36th Alabama. A very clear case of a soldier taking advantage of the prisoner system involved Captain John B. Jordan of the 36th Alabama, a regiment in the Army of Tennessee during the Atlanta campaign. Jordan's superior, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas H. Herndon, reported on August 14, 64, that the captain, quote, failed last night to report with his detail of pickets. Jordan had a good record as a company commander, but Herndon regretted to admit, quote, that the facts of the case indicate too plainly and painfully that he deliberately and basely deserted his colors and went over to the enemy. Jordan not only deserted, but he told the Federals everything he knew. We know that because of an interrogation report published in the official records. He encouraged Union officers to arrange more truces along the lines to allow more Confederates to desert. In fact, Jordan himself deserted during such an informal truce on the night of August 13th. But Jordan's is not a simple case of desertion. This is an example where a Confederate service record gives us lots of information. He took the oath of allegiance to the U.S. government at Chattanooga on August 22, 1864. Federal authorities thereafter transported him to Louisville, ironically, where they released him in September on condition that he remain north of the Ohio River for the duration of the war. Jordan soon grew tired of life in the North. He crossed hostile lines again in February 65. He made his way to Virginia, and he tried to rehabilitate his record with CS authorities. He wrote a letter claiming that he had been captured, not deserted, on the night of August 13th, that he had escaped from a railroad car on the way to prison in Indiana and had made his way to Canada. From there, he sailed to Nassau and ran the blockade to enter Wilmington, North Carolina in early December 1864. What a wonderful story. Upon going to Richmond, he found himself officially listed as a deserter. Jordan requested a court of inquiry to clear his name. That court was never convened because Jordan convinced Herndon, his regimental commander, that his story was true. Herndon bought all of it and allowed Jordan to resume duty with his company because he believed the captain had been, quote, forcibly captured and carried away by the enemy. Well, what do we conclude from this? A normally reliable company commander deserted to obtain some relief from the stress of soldier life during the Atlanta campaign. After a short period of rest in the North, his optimism and his strength returned, and he felt guilty about what he had done. The only way to restore his record was to concoct lies about how and why he left the company. His commander needed officers, that's the bottom line, and did not ask questions. Jordan served out the remainder of the war. He crossed Union lines to take the oath of allegiance once again on April 19, 1865 in Alabama. Case study number 3, Egypt Station. An unusual incident of federal prisoners of war who elected to join the CS Army cropped up late in the conflict during John Bell Hood's invasion of Tennessee in the fall of 1864. Federal forces mounted attacks on the Mobile and Ohio Railroad to impede Hood's ability to supply his army in Tennessee. Brigadier General Benjamin H. Grierson left Memphis with 3,500 cavalry on December 21, 1864. He damaged the railroad until hitting a small Confederate force at Egypt Station, Mississippi, December 28th. The Confederates numbered only 200 cavalry and 300 so-called galvanized Irishmen, a name given to federal prisoners of war at Andersonville who volunteered to serve in the CS Army because many of them were foreign-born immigrants. These Federals turned Confederates were recruited and commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Michael Burke, while Brigadier General Samuel J. Golson led the combined rebel force. When the Federals attacked on the morning of December 28th, they met stiff resistance from the galvanized Irish. Burke's men fought well, reportedly stopping the Federal attack, but they could not prevent the Unionists from flanking their position. So Golson ordered Burke's troops to take refuge in a stockade, where they continued to fight vigorously till overwhelmed. The Yankees turned Confederates were largely responsible for the 22 killed and 100 wounded Federal soldiers in this small but sharp battle. Grierson, by the way, captured 500 Confederates that day, and about half of them were so-called galvanized Irishmen. After the raid on the Mobile and Ohio Railroad, Federal authorities were divided on how to treat these galvanized Irish. Grierson believed they had joined Confederate service only, quote, to escape a loathsome confinement, and he recommended clemency. Another Union officer, Colonel John W. Noble, who was in charge of transporting these captured men from Vicksburg to Cairo by river steamer, confirmed that several of them deserted to U.S. forces on the evening of December 27th and gave information of the Confederate force opposed to us and reported that many of these men would not resist us in battle. Noble also confirmed that most of these men joined C.S. ranks to escape the horrid conditions of Andersonville, but he was not so sure they deserved clemency, given that they obviously fought very stubbornly at Egypt Station. Noble concluded that most of these galvanized Irish, quote, are worthy of clemency, a few are worthy of special favor, but many at the same time are not to be trusted. Well, the question of clemency was entirely in the hands of the Washington bureaucrats. The commissary of prisoners, William Hoffman, recommended against it. And the Bureau of Military Justice within the War Department agreed. In May 1865, Major A.A. Hosmer of the Bureau noted that several Union officers reported the turncoats had offered very heavy resistance at Egypt Station. The galvanized Irishman claimed to have enlisted in the CS Army to escape suffering and intended to desert as soon as possible. Even if this were true, Hosmer wrote, it would not justify their conduct. And it is believed the government cannot consistently recognize the propriety of prisoners who escape by such means and cannot place confidence in men who, even for the purpose of escaping the horrors of southern prisons, were willing to enter the ranks of the rebel army. Hosmer continued to deny the validity of these men's claims to clemency. The circumstances of the action in which they were captured do not justify the belief that any considerable portion of these men had any desire or intention to rejoin our forces. Being placed upon the skirmish line, they could readily have made an opportunity to pass over without suspicion on the part of the enemy. And if not, at least they could have fired so as to do no damage to our troops. The deadly precision of their fire shows that they intended to repel our forces. They are not entitled to any clemency. As to their present status, it may be remarked that they should no longer be regarded as prisoners of war, but should be held and tried as deserters. Now, the opinion of many Confederate soldiers about these Yankees turned Confederates was entirely negative. William Pitt Chambers of the 46th Mississippi Army of Tennessee came into contact with many Northerners recruited into the CS Army about the time of the Battle of Egypt Station, although he never knew any of those particular galvanized Irishmen. There is a small battalion attached to this brigade, Chambers wrote in his journal. They belong to the criminal class, and more than 20 cases are reported in the past few days in which both whites and Negroes have been robbed and in many cases personally assaulted by them. They are scattered all over the country through which we have passed and are said to be committing all sorts of depredations. Some of them are not fit to be called men. Many have already deserted to the enemy, and others say they would do the same at the first opportunity. It was an unwise step to enlist them, and if they still wore the federal uniform, they would be less harmful to us. It is said, he continued, some of them fought bravely at Egypt a few weeks ago, before they were captured by Colonel Grierson, perhaps so. They do well to dread capture, but I would rather they were safely locked in Andersonville prison than be here. That's a damning condemnation. In the end, the authorities in Washington decided to overlook the fact that these men had donned Confederate gray. They adopted a suggestion from Major General Grenville Dodge that the Egypt Station prisoners be allowed to join the 5th and 6th U.S. Volunteers, regiments consisting of Confederate prisoners of war who had volunteered to serve on the frontier in the U.S. Army. Now, in conclusion, one wonders how common it was for soldiers to use the prisoner system for their ulterior aims. We do know that Civil War commanders were aware of the problem. And, Lorian, this is something you mentioned a while ago. William Rosecrans felt it necessary to issue a general order in the fall of 1862 after taking command of the Department of the Cumberland. Many soldiers have sought and allowed themselves to be captured and paroled by the enemy to escape from further military duty and in order to be sent home, the order read. This was even more base and cowardly than desertion, which at least had a semblance of courage when contrasted with voluntary capture. Now, let me bring some broader context to this issue by bracketing the Civil War within the context of the larger scope of military history, specifically with the American Revolution and the Chinese Civil War of the mid-20th century. How's that for internationalizing the Civil War? Daniel Krebs found a good example of this issue among prisoners in the American Revolution. And he's talked with you about that already this morning. Americans assumed German soldiers fighting for the British had been coerced into the army by greedy German monarchs, and they wanted to believe they could lure those German prisoners to defect and join the American cause. Never panned out to any significant degree. The main problem seems to have been the apparent inability of the Patriot government to provide well for their soldiers, plus honor and a desire to go home. Very few German prisoners took the Americans up on this offer. For example, in one sample of 2,000 German soldiers, only 4.4% enlisted in the American Army. Daniel noted that 50 Germans captured in 1777 enlisted in the American cause from captivity in the fall of 1782, and that they served as Marines on the frigate South Carolina. As you know, the British captured this vessel, took the men to New York. All of them denied the charge of defection, claiming they had enlisted in the American cause in order to escape captivity. They claimed they had heard the British were preparing to capture the South Carolina, so they volunteered to serve on it. The officers of these men accepted their explanation and reinstated them. And in a situation that foreshadowed the galvanized Irishmen of Egypt Station, the 50 Germans who had volunteered as Marines on the South Carolina had actually fought very hard on the ship, together with American seamen, to avoid British capture. These seemingly powerless captives, Daniel concludes, had manipulated the revolutionaries, the British Navy, and German officers, playing them off against each other to their own advantage. Finally, jump all the way to the late 1940s into Asia to see an interesting example from the Civil War in China and the Korean conflict of more than 21,000 Chinese prisoners held by the United Nations Command. 14,000 refused repatriation to China after the armistice was signed on July 27, 1953. The explanation for such a high percentage of Chinese prisoners refusing repatriation stems from the Chinese communist effort to strengthen their army by recruiting from among captured nationalist soldiers during the preceding years of the Chinese Civil War. The communists developed a pretty effective system for doing so, treating nationalist prisoners well at first, then indoctrinating them about the evils of the nationalist government, the virtues of the communists. Then they staged so-called speak bitterness meetings in which the nationalist prisoners were encouraged to voice criticism of their former government. They also planted stooges in the crowd to prime the pump in this way and get criticism started. In Chinese culture, it's important to go with the flow and with the majority, so this was a way to get that ball rolling. After the vocal criticism developed, everyone was encouraged to voluntarily join the communist army, and many did. Those who refused got more indoctrination and were released. The communists thought it was important to get voluntary enlistments, and they went to great lengths to coerce the nationalist prisoners to do so. In fact, of the more than 21,000 Chinese prisoners in UN hands, nearly two-thirds of them had been nationalist soldiers before joining the communist forces. Once again, we are faced with the basic question: how do we interpret the fact that in many wars, prisoners used the prisoner system in ways it was never intended to be used? At the least, we can see the prisoner system as a fluid borderland between belligerents rather than as an immutable system. We can note that all of these cases involved belligerents, well, most of them anyway, who came from the same culture, spoke the same language. They all were, to a degree, civil wars. Maybe this kind of crossing over is more endemic in such conflicts than in wars that pit very different cultures. The interesting thing to me is not so much that a prisoner decides to go to the other side, but that he takes the next step and decides to come back to the original side and somehow negotiates it successfully without punishment. That's the key, I think, to this interesting phenomenon that demands further study and explanation. Thank you very much.
So hello, everyone. My name is Dan Farrell, and of course, thanks again to the people who put together the conference, and thank you for inviting me to speak with you guys today. So my paper is entitled Ration Reduction and the Collective Criminalization of Confederate Soldiers During the Civil War. So yes, we'll be having yet another Civil War paper presented at today's conference. So, as newspapers printed stories and editorials attesting to the suffering of federal prisoners in southern prisons, many civilians began calling for retaliatory measures. Public advocates for these policies often juxtaposed the idea that while the United States treated rebel prisoners with kindness and humanity, southerners had purposely subjected Union prisoners to disease, starvation, and death. Shocked by the disturbing accounts they had read in the newspaper, the Chicago Board of Trustees had solicited the federal government asking them to implement a policy of retaliation. Writing directly to the president on October 20th, 1864, the board claimed to have read authentic sources attesting to Southern cruelty and urged Abraham Lincoln to induce retaliatory measures as a matter of necessity. The board suggested that Confederate soldiers should be either shot or starved to death, and that the government should carry out such actions, whether in prison or on the battlefield. After having read the letter, Lincoln submitted it to Major General Ethan Allen Hitchcock, who recommended that harsh retaliatory measures suggested by the Chicago board were unnecessary, as an agreement between Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant had recently been brokered to provide supplies to ailing prisoners. The War Department instructed the Assistant Adjutant General L.H. Palouse to inform the men of this decision. Closely mirroring the language originally used by Hitchcock's recommendation, Palouse wrote the Chicago Board informing them that recent events had rendered unnecessary a resort to the terrible means of retaliation recommended. The significance of the story may not appear immediately obvious. After all, the War Department decided that the situation did not require the utilization of such hard measures. It raises a few questions, however. What created a situation in which civilians would feel emboldened enough to write the president asking directly for retaliation, and why did the War Department feel the need to entertain such a request? The answer to this question, I believe, lies within existing military policies that already governed the physical bodies of Confederate prisoners, as well as the state's desire to impart upon its captives a criminal distinction, allowing the state to retain control of the very life essence of its prisoners. In turn, the state could use this power to determine when and where the prisoners could eat, how much clothes they could possess, and whether or not they could move freely or be subject to close confinement. This paper, however, is not about atrocities or suffering. Such debates are already well covered within the literature. Instead, this research is concerned with power, its genesis, and its expression. The work on Civil War prisons has yet to take the functional role of the United States prisoner of war system as a natural extension of the nation's sovereign power that seriously. Theoretical works can help us begin this process, as political theorists for quite a while have been attempting to locate the origins of sovereign power within modernizing nation states. Yet precisely because the control of the physical body was deliberately at the heart of regulatory measures designed for prisoners of war, these extrajudicial functionaries are thus situated nicely within certain theoretical models of sovereignty, state power, and what Carl Schmitt originally described as the state of exception. Schmitt defined sovereignty as the head of state to not only declare the present situation as an extreme emergency, but also to grant themselves the power to suspend normal judicial and constitutional proceedings for the self-preservation of the state. Giorgio Agamben has built on these ideas specifically to locate the hidden point of intersection between the judicial, institutional, and biopolitical modes of power. Since for Agamben, the state of exception was more than simply a theory about sovereign delineations of power during times of crisis. Rather, it was about the sovereign's ability to place life and death both simultaneously within and outside judicial processes in order to arbitrate on human life for the continued health of the state. Taking this seriously will hopefully reorient scholars to help to begin looking at the prisoner of war system in a new light. However, it is not the desire of this work to parrot the arguments of Agavin, but rather to advance them by bringing attention to some of his faults. Agavin's insistence on analogizing the very essence of Western democracy with Nazi concentration camps has caused some of his work, rightfully so, to be seen as melodramatic. Fixated on metaphysics and the most extraordinary abuses, Agavin has left little in the way of tangible evidence to substantiate his claims, much less providing any historical contingency or accounting for the human agency that both informs historical research and shapes the enforcement of sovereign power. To the latter point, changes in prison policy were not arbitrary actions, as they often followed a predictable pattern. If the policy change had something to do with the physical well-being of the Confederate prisoner, it normally followed an accusation that the Confederacy had engaged itself in a criminal act. Stated differently, accusations of Confederate criminality resulted in the punishing of Confederate prisoners of war who were not parties to the alleged crime. Edward Sands' directive to reduce rations by 20% will serve as the illustrated example of this phenomenon. However, suspending the cartel or the refusal of Confederate officials to exchange African-American soldiers serves as another example of this pattern. Not only did it condemn Southerners to languish in Northern prisons indefinitely, but it also made them available to receive punishment on behalf of war crimes committed by other persons. The United States also threatened other small-scale acts of retaliation on Confederate prisoners in response to alleged abuses. For just one example, when the War Department learned that the Confederacy was holding two Union prisoners in close confinement under the accusation that they were spies, two Confederate soldiers of equal rank were selected as hostages to receive the same treatment. Additionally, Agavin's notion of power is also quite linear. In critiquing Michel Foucault's rather amorphous and totalitizing theories of power relations, Agavin has labored to redirect our attention to the nation-state as a proper enforcer of will. While this is a necessary corrective, it does once again remove human agency from the equation. In understanding imbalances of power, Agavin is perhaps right to streamline our attention back to the state, but it needs to be recognized that popular will often supports state structures. It was exceedingly rare for the Northern public to critique the Union's prisoner of war system. The only notable exception was when the public demanded harsher treatment. William B. Heseltine originally referred to this as a war psychosis, but is perhaps better identified as either a form of complicity or a simple desire to see Southerners punished for their crimes. Constructing the rebels as criminals had lasting consequences, particularly in denying them an avenue to claim grievances and collect compensation for abuses suffered in prison. The post-war animosities over the prison system tested the limits of reconciliation by collectively criminalizing all Southerners as complicit in the alleged war crimes carried out by Jefferson Davis's administration. What is remarkable, however, is the sheer degree of power subsumed by the War Department to manage the lives of over 200,000 individuals. This was an unprecedented expansion of state power in United States history. What is entirely consistent with the modernizing tendencies of 19th century nation states. Few scholars have remarked on this, although Paul Springer has acknowledged that the Union's prisoner of war system grew increasingly more sophisticated in response to the unprecedented challenge of housing so many men. Such a totalizing feature fits nicely within Agavin's notion of biopolitics, because the camps themselves became centers of imprisonment for a servile population. As Agavin has observed, when a state of emergency is extended to an entire civil population, camps are thus born not out of ordinary law or criminal law, but out of a state of exception and martial law. While the Lincoln administration did practice restraint, Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus in September of 1862 did authorize new sweeping measures to categorize and control the population. Lincoln's proclamation authorized the arrest and imprisonment of all rebels and insurgents, their aides and abettors, and all persons discouraging volunteer enlistments, resisting military draft, or guilty of any disloyal practice affording aid and comfort to rebels against the authority of the United States. Lincoln continued by declaring that all shall be imprisoned in any fort, camp, arsenal, military prison, or other place of confinement by any military authority or by the sentence of any court-martial or military commission. Such a proclamation was not born out of peacetime judicial norms, but was rather the product of an emergency declaration made by a desperate nation state struck with an internal insurrection that threatened the very existence of the nation. The proclamation also worked in tandem with the United States military prison system. Some scholars have doubted the military utility of the prisons, but similar to Lincoln's proclamation, the prison system was born out of emergency law and not democratic processes. In the opening months of the war, the Union's prison system was run somewhat haphazardly, but slowly came to embody bureaucratic efficiency with the establishment of the Office of the Commissary General of Prisoners. Ran by William Hoffman, the War Department originally placed his office under the control of the quartermaster Montgomery C. Meigs, but it soon came under the direct supervision of Edwin Stanton. To help consolidate Hoffman's power and standardize the treatment of all prisoners, the War Department ordered that the supervision of prisoners of war sent by generals commanding in the fields to posts or camps prepared for their reception is placed entirely under Colonel William Hoffman, that Hoffman was subject only to the orders of the War Department, and that all matters in relation to prisoners would pass through him. Controlling the prisoners was a priority of the War Department, and Hoffman was granted tremendous power to control and discipline the prison population. But Hoffman's power was not unlimited. He lacked the authority to release prisoners, which was a power jealously guarded by the War Department. Hoffman was also, unsurprisingly, required to implement and enforce any general policy changes directed by Edwin Stanton. For example, Stanton broadened the scope of the military prison system to include civilian prisoners, and Lincoln's administration understood the military utility of this move. In reply to a Senate inquiry considering the status of state prisoners, Stanton revealed that certain prisons, such as Fort Warren and Fort Lafayette, were to be used by the direction of the president for the custody of persons seized by naval officers while engaged in blockade running or illicit trade, as well as prisoners who were not specified in the Act of Congress of March 3, 1863. The secession of exchanges has also been a contentious point of historical debate, but a small episode may help shed some insight into the issue of military necessity. When Massachusetts Governor John A. Andrews solicited for the early exchange of Captain Edward S. Daniels, a wounded African-American prisoner of war, the War Department denied the governor's request. It is perhaps telling that Palouz did not blame Confederate policy, but rather stated that special exchanges are not approved except for public reasons. As it happened, Daniels remained a prisoner until March 8th of 1865. Thus, changes in prison policy, as previously stated, often came on the heels of an accusation that the Confederacy had committed a war crime of some sorts. Thus, through a pervasive system of control rooted in martial law, the Union's military prison system also contributed to the normalizing the belief that Southerners were, in some sense of the word, criminals. This development can be traced from at least the opening moments of the war. In Lincoln's July 4, 1861 address to Congress, he clearly lays out the problem by stating that an illegal organization in the character of the Confederate States was already invoking recognition, aid, and intervention from foreign powers for the purposes of overthrowing the national government. Heseltine has also perceptively observed that the paramount issue confronting the problem of prisoners of war was in avoiding the recognition of Confederate sovereignty. So although the prisoners were largely treated as enemy combatants, the administration refused to admit that their captives were anything other than traitors, as Heseltine put it. This type of discourse had consequences. The impetus to reduce the prisoners' rations came in response to the mounting outcry that Southerners had been abusing Union prisoners. Eyewitness accounts of former prisoners held at Bell's Island painted a grim picture of death and starvation that quickly reached the attention of government officials. Hoffman immediately recommended that the government investigate abuses at Bell's Island and to enact retaliatory measures if the accounts proved true. In a follow-up report, Hoffman observed that the paroled prisoners returning from Bell's Island were in abysmal shape and claimed that it was irrefutable evidence that the Union soldiers in the hands of rebels are being starved to death. Stanton instructed Benjamin Wade's joint committee on the conduct of the war to investigate the issue, claiming that the enormity of the crime committed by the rebels towards our prisoners for the last several months is not known or realized by our people and cannot but fill with horror the civilized world when the facts are fully revealed. Although the investigations into Bell's Island was not the first time the Northern public had accused the South of mistreating Union prisoners, these investigations did roughly coincide with the massacre at Fort Pillow, reinforcing notions of Southern cruelty and criminality. Stanton recommended to the president that retaliatory measures should be taken against Confederate officers, since a large proportion of the privates in the rebel army are forced there by conscription and are held in arms by terror and rigorous punishment by their officers. But despite such lofty sentiments by the Secretary of War, the primary consequence of the massacre, as Springer and Robbins argued, worked to give political cover to Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, who ordered the reduction by 20% of rations to the Confederate prisoners. Therefore, ration reduction fell hardest upon the enlisted soldiers who normally lived in far worse conditions than the officer corps. While it may be impossible to know the extent of the damage, reduced rations did hurt the prisoners physically, and they were made to receive punishment for crimes that they did not necessarily commit. Discourse remains an understudied aspect of the Civil War, but there was always a general theme throughout the conflict that attested to this Confederate criminality. The spring of 1864 helped to sustain these discourses, however. Benjamin Cloyd has perceptively pointed out that the Northern public met changes in prison policy with a disturbing lack of protest. Such complicity worked to legitimate the United States sovereign authority to manage the lives of its rebellious citizens bureaucratically. This lack of protest was perhaps the result of renewed effort to propagandize the war crimes being committed by the Confederacy. Journalists had already been allowed to observe the condition of returning prisoners from at least 1863, and they had used that opportunity to report on the horrible condition of the returning prisoners. But the investigations that were born out of Bell's Island and Fort Pillow provided Stanton with the opportunity to further the narrative. Stanton allowed newspapers to reprint shocking images of emaciated prisoners. Wade also produced 20,000 copies of his investigating report on the condition of returned prisoners for public distribution. Newspapers remarked on Wade's report with shock and disgust, drawing a strong association between the actions of the Confederate state and the conditions of the Union prisoners. One paper reported that the committee cannot resist the conclusion that these inhuman practices are the result of a determination on the part of rebel authorities to reduce our soldiers by privations and exposure, with the result, like the massacre at Fort Pillow, to be of a predetermined policy. Another paper expressed a similar sentiment, claiming that the utter wickedness and cruelty of the rebel leaders finds their worst exhibition in the cruel treatment of our prisoners. So similar to the story of the Chicago Board of Trustees, citizens throughout the North called for retaliation. Angered, rightfully so, over Fort Pillow, a Connecticut newspaper encouraged the government to inflict the severest retaliatory measures it could to address a crime that had no parallel in history. The Massachusetts State Legislature passed resolutions urging Congress to adopt measures in retaliation for the treatment of our officers and soldiers held by the rebels. State officials chimed in as well. In the aftermath of Lincoln's assassination, again, Massachusetts Governor Andrews addressed his state legislature by stating that the barbarism which originated treason and rebellion against a government free, which hunted and hanged political dissenters, starved to death its prisoners of war, and desecrated the remains of the fallen brave, have now added assassination to the blistering record of its crimes. Thus, collective criminalization extended well beyond the conflict's conclusion, and the continued animosity over the prison system tested the limits of reconciliation that often gave Republican candidates a political platform to exploit. But scholars have largely overlooked the mechanisms, both theoretic and tangible, that gave rise to the military prison system. They have also overlooked its implicit military function that was designed to house and control a servile population. The previous literature has taken for granted that the war would produce such a system, but it was a result of intellectual shifts that had only just started to occur over the past century. Devoting substantial time and resources to imprisonment marks a turn in global history in which nation states were becoming more preoccupied with managing and controlling large civilian populations against insurrection. The power assumed by the United States was both unprecedented in its size and scope, and the public sustained it by either not caring or believing that the system was to be intolerably too lenient. Control over the prisoners was therefore largely removed from democratic outlets, with the prisoners themselves having no control over their fates. They had truly become, as Agamben had put it, bare life, subject only to the will of the state. Discourses of criminality also helped to stave off criticism by shifting the public narrative towards justification, allowing the North, particularly Republican politicians, to claim moral superiority in their quest for reuniting the nation. But Agamben himself has been careful to remind his readers that these totalitizing expressions of state power do not inherently lead to atrocity. Rather, when the normal order is suspended, whether or not atrocities are to be committed depends not on law, but on the civility and the ethical sense of those who are acting as sovereign. The United States did practice restraint, and it did not implement a deliberate policy to starve the prisoners, but it should be acknowledged that the United States never relinquished its control of the prisoners to any meaningful democratic oversight, and always reserved the right to change policy based on the shifting needs of the state, shifts that were often in response to Confederate war crimes. Thus, the audience should not see this as a blanket condemnation of the Union, but rather an opportunity to gain new insight into how nation states have used their military prison systems to further political and military goals in ways that are not immediately obvious. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. So let me echo my predecessors by thanking the conference conveners, Lorian, Daniel, thank you. Leanne, the staff of the Filson, all the audience members, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you. So I'm going to go off script a little bit, partly because I have insomnia, so I've been up since about 3:15 thinking about German prisoners of war. So you're going to suffer for that. So, but I am conscious of the fact that I'm all that's standing between you and an afternoon cocktail, so I'll try to confine my remarks to less than 75 minutes. How about that? Anyway, so what I want to talk to you about today is a particular prisoner of war camp. So in World War II, Fort Hunt, Virginia, codenamed P.O. Box 1142, which was its mailing address, was an interrogation facility where we held German prisoners of war. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little background on that and then sort of get into the meat of the paper a little bit and talk about sort of what the U.S. obtained from these prisoners of war. So I'm trying to get at the value. There's a lot of talk about prisoners of war in World War II in the United States. Very little, and lots of documentation in the archives, but very little look at actually what value this intelligence provided the U.S. So that's what I'm going to try to get at. So I'm going to kind of scratch the surface. But just a little background. So Fort Hunt is about 5 miles from Mount Vernon. So it's a little outside Washington, D.C., just a short distance. There were actually three programs that ran simultaneously at Fort Hunt. The first was called the Military Intelligence Research Section. This was overwhelmingly American personnel who simply read and translated captured enemy documents. Okay. The second program was called MISX, which was to aid, the purpose of this program was to aid American prisoners of war in enemy custody. And so they developed things like radios that could be disguised as American baseballs and Monopoly board games that you could slip money and maps into, so kind of James Bondish kind of things. It's related to the British MI9, if you're related to the British system. That has almost no surviving documentation, so what little we know about MIS M-I-S-X, I say that three times really fast, comes solely from one of the commanding officers who wrote a book about it, but there's almost no documentation left. So what I want to talk about is MISY, which was the program for the interrogation of German prisoners of war. So just a comment to Adam's, Adam made a comment in his paper about the U.S. would bend the rules for Japanese prisoners of war, but not Germans. I might assure you with this that the U.S. would bend the rules if it suited their purpose for either, if they could get away with it. So Geneva Convention requires certain things that the U.S. managed to skirt with this program. First, they're not supposed to interrogate prisoners of war, and this was an entire program that devoted 4 years of its existence to doing that very thing. They're also supposed to report where prisoners of war are physically located, and the U.S. skirted that as well. They would not report the existence of Fort Hunt, Virginia. And so what they did was they would report to the Red Cross, the Swiss Protecting Power, that these prisoners were held at either Pine Grove Furnace or Fort Meade, Maryland, and they would go so far as to ship them through one of those two. Fort Meade in particular was they would just literally transit through there so they could say these folks are at Fort Meade, Maryland, when in fact they were actually housed at Fort Hunt. So anyway, but Fort Hunt was actually pretty small, so it would only hold about 60 POWs initially. In 1944, they expanded that to 108 total, but still was a small operation, and you'll understand why here in a second. So they selected these prisoners in large measure. The comment that you asked earlier about the questionnaires, I mean, the Americans almost bordered on obsession with trying to figure out which of their prisoners were Nazis and which ones weren't. And so these interrogators from Fort Hunt would actually go to the ports of debarkation and read through the questionnaires, look at the prisoners' personal belongings, sometimes interview them to try to figure out whether they had any value to the United States or not, intelligence-wise. And if they thought they did, they'd flag them, and these folks would be sent through Fort Hunt. So their stays at Fort Hunt lasted anywhere from 7 or 8 days to an entire month, depending on how many other prisoners they wanted to interrogate or how much information they were getting from them. So interestingly, Fort Hunt was paired with another interrogation facility. So in 1942, the U.S. determined that they wanted one interrogation facility on the East Coast to interrogate German prisoners of war, and they wanted one on the West Coast to interrogate Japanese prisoners of war. So Fort Hunt was selected for Germans on the East Coast. A resort, they actually chose a former resort called Byron Hot Springs that's right outside Tracy, California, for the Japanese prisoners of war. There were eventually Germans that went there, too, because of a dearth of Japanese prisoners to interrogate. So there were some Germans that found themselves in California also. But Fort Hunt processed a great deal more prisoners than did Byron Hot Springs. Okay, so the total in the years of its existence were 3,451 German prisoners of war that were processed through Fort Hunt. Okay, and again, these range from the lowest. They tracked these numbers by quarter, not by month. So the lowest quarter were 69 prisoners they processed, and the highest number, 594 at the highest quarter. And this would be, anybody that's interested in World War II, it would be obvious which months were the greatest or which quarters were the greatest. Following the German surrender in Tunisia in May of 43, you get 3-4 months of a lot of POWs, drops back off, and then certainly following the Allied invasion of Normandy, you get several months when there's literally hundreds of folks they're processing through Fort Hunt. So it follows in a pretty predictable cycle. And, of course, the number of days they spend there is inversely proportional to the number of POWs they're trying to process, right? So what really gets interesting then is also the manner in which they obtained this intelligence. So it would appear overwhelmingly that most of the intelligence came simply from direct interrogation. So these interrogators the leadership would try to pair an appropriate interrogator with an appropriate prisoner of war based on common interests and background. And these gentlemen would try to build relationships with them. They would take them for walks. They would share a cigarette with them. They played chess with them. They did a variety of things to try to ease the flow of conversation, right? The other thing that really gets interesting is they also embedded, as the British did, microphones in the light fixtures of their rooms, in the vents, in the walls. Even went so far as to embed microphones in the trees around the grounds of Fort Hunt. And they had a central switchboard that could turn these microphones off and on. So as prisoners would walk by a tree, like we know they're going down the sidewalk, flip those microphones on, and we can listen to these prisoners talking to each other as they meander around Fort Hunt. Right, so the British were so sophisticated, they had buttons in the trees, and interrogators could take them for walks and bump the tree, and it would flip on the microphone. So I got pretty ingenious with some of these things. But these things worked in tandem, so again, the interrogations were often the vehicle through which they got a lot of their information, but they could then check for reliability, because they'd interrogate a prisoner, send them back to their room, flip on the microphones in their room, and listen to them tell their roommate whether they lied or didn't lie, which they would often do candidly, like, oh, the Americans asked me this question, and I told them I didn't know, but actually, here's what the truth is. So they could assess reliability and sometimes get other nuggets of information that way also. So the real question then becomes, what did they get? Well, maybe two questions. What did they get, and what did they do with that information? Okay, so so what this paper is going to address is sort of what they got. So this is a little hard to get at. So the total files for Fort Hunt run to something like 100,000 pages in the National Archives. So overwhelmingly, that is the transcripts of the conversations that were either between interrogators and prisoners or between prisoners that were surreptitiously recorded from microphones. Okay, so you can actually go to the archives and pull these things. Some of these things, I won't lie to you and tell you I've read all these because I haven't, not even close. But some of the ones I've read, and I've read some of the ones in the British files too, because the British had a very similar operation. Absolutely fascinating stuff. And then there's a German historian, Suke Neitzel, he's written a couple of books using some of these files, and it's really fascinating stuff. He's looking at different questions, but it's really interesting what prisoners of war will divulge, first of all, to interrogators whom they know were trying to get information from them, but also under microphones where you can't always tell whether the prisoner suspects they're being listened to or not, so there's kind of an observer's paradox potentially, but they cough up all kinds of interesting information. So what I'm looking at specifically here is there were 240 reports from POWs that were sent to the U.S. Army European Theater of Operations beginning shortly after their arrival in Europe. So beginning roughly 1st of July 1944 until late in December of 45, they're sending these reports to Europe. And so, again, there's these number 240. And so this was the stuff I thought was worth focusing on, because apparently the stuff that the interrogators at Fort Hunt and the command thought were contained information that was important enough to send to the U.S. Army in Europe. Right. So, interestingly, even in that regard, the sequence of numbers actually runs well past 500. So they start numbering about 1,200, and the numbers run up over 1,700, but there are only 240 in existence. So there may have been a number more than that, as many as twice that number, simply that weren't saved, or that they reported and then destroyed. I'm not sure how to account for that, but there are only 240 remaining in the National Archives. So. And these were sent, again, to the U.S. Army European Theater of Operations, sent to the U.S. Navy, U.S. Army Service Forces, the Office of Strategic Services, and then also to the British Combined Services Detailed Interrogation Center. So these reports sometimes were in the reports copied in the 40s and 50s, 40 or 50 copies of each report that were disseminated throughout the American and British command. So this did get some fairly wide traffic. So in looking at these, so I kind of catalog these 240 reports, and try to get a sense of, again, what kind of information are we actually getting from prisoners of war, right? And what I found, and this is my own cataloging here, so you could probably take a little dispute if you look through these about how I cataloged them, but this is sort of, in general, what I found. 9 distinct categories of information that the U.S. got from prisoners of war, okay? Number 1, war production and industrial installations. 2, German and Italian defensive works. 3, German morale and opinions. They're very interested in German morale. 4, the situation in various cities or countries. So they'd actually do like a country report. They'd find a prisoner who had lived in, say, Yugoslavia, for instance, for 15 years, and he might give a complete report about his assessment of the situation in Yugoslavia. 5, German assessments of the Allied war effort. So whether that's Allied tactics, Allied propaganda, they were very interested, were the Allies, in what the Germans thought of them. Right, so and this goes well beyond the war when the U.S. is still investigating with how the Germans did things. Okay, 6, so German military tactics, training, order of battle, that kind of thing. 7, German weapons and military technology. 8, German politics and personalities. And 9, the German relationship with Japan, okay, which for obvious reasons, right? The single most discussed topic was war production and industrial installations. So of the 240 reports, 85 of them deal with war production or installations in some regard, right? 65 of the reports provide information about German politics and personalities. 60 involved German tactics, training, order of battle, and 44 about weapons and military technology. And then the others, the five categories range anywhere from 5 to 29. Okay, so depends on what you get. So just to give you a little sampling here of this. Again, so a couple things to note about these reports. So first of all, oftentimes these reports were amalgamations of multiple, of information from multiple prisoners of war. So they don't isolate one prisoner or one topic. It was more done by chronology. So it's June the 8th, we've got four guys here, we interrogate them about what they know, we lump all the best stuff together in this report, and we'll send it to the Army. All right. So some of these reports go on to wildly different topics. All right. So report 1230, for instance. One of the prisoners was an electrician from Brandenburg who had worked in a bunch of installations around the city of Brandenburg. So he gives them all kinds of information about German military installations in that city, things they might potentially want to bomb, and the defenses of Brandenburg. Another prisoner gave similar things for the harbor and other installations around Regensburg, Germany. On the same report is a German soldier who had been in Italy, and he gave an assessment of American artillery fire at Anzio. He said it wasn't very good, by the way. So the Americans were, again, all ears with stuff like that, like how can we improve this? So he said a great many of the artillery shells were duds, right? And then in the same report was a German POW who had lived in Yugoslavia for 17 years and gave a report on German, or Yugoslavian partisan units and other aspects of Yugoslavia during the war. So, again, that's one sampling. Similar kinds of things. Report 1274 details a prisoner who had been involved with the defenses in Norway. And this guy gave such a detailed report, he not only described the defenses, but he described even dummies. The Germans had set up dummy sites to try to trick the Allies into bombing sites that weren't actually guns. They were fakes. So he's trying to, how accurate this was, I don't know. I'm going to have to follow that up. But he's giving this some pretty detailed information about the coastal defenses in Norway here, right? And then another prisoner in that same report that talks about the effectiveness of Allied propaganda. So leaflets that the U.S. had dropped behind German lines said, by and large, American propaganda was very good, that it actually, according to him anyway, that a lot of the German soldiers, particularly as the food supply got lower and lower, paid more and more attention to American pamphlets saying, yeah, you should surrender, you'll get better food, which the record would bear out would be true. So couple of more here, and then we'll hit a couple of themes here, and then we'll wrap up. But one of the prisoners was also an Austrian Social Democratic Party official before being conscripted into the German army. So he spoke at length about underground movements in Germany, three different groups, the Communist Party, the Revolutionary Socialists, and the Catholic Youth, gave pretty in-depth discussions of these and what kind of work they may or may not have been doing in Germany. Ultimately concluded that none of them had any value by that point to the Allies because they had been so suppressed by the Gestapo that they would not be worth collaborating with at the end. But again, information that the U.S. would have been interested in. Right? So certainly lots of technology. The U.S. is very interested, again, even after the war, in German military technology. So several of the prisoners could speak to jet fighters, Messerschmitt 262s and other German planes, and then the tactics they used with these planes that the U.S. found very, very interesting. Also, okay, so, but this report about some of the technology, sometimes that information was so sought after that the U.S. would sometimes perhaps risk a little bit less reliable prisoners. So one of these reports in which there's a pilot who's talking about their Messerschmitt 109, the 163, and the 262, the report also notes that this prisoner provided this information, quote, reluctantly and was inclined to exaggerate. However, some of the information confirms already known facts. It is believed that the report may be of interest, but should be treated with reserve, end quote. Right. So clearly, screening these prisoners for how reliable they are. Again, we talked some about how they could do that. Like certainly check with, they've captured documents. So the MIRS program at Fort Hunt was useful for that, too. You could check prisoner testimony against their own documents. Again, the microphones. But still, it's the prospect of really accurately determining and entirely reliable how much the information you're going to get from a prisoner of war is a dicey prospect. And the same is also true with, again, this trying to determine which prisoners were Nazis and which ones were not Nazis is a thorny proposition that there's also a lot of confusion. This is true in the British documents also, where the Americans tend to associate nice, cooperative, cultured prisoners with anti-Nazis, and stubborn, militaristic, Prussians as Nazis. Some of those are unrelated items, but that's how this bears out. So you could almost tell before they labeled one as they start describing them what they're going to conclude as they go along. So it's a bit of a thorny issue. So one of the things to note about these reports, too, is that, again, very interested in German morale. They actually, on regular interval, I mean, for understandable reasons, at regular intervals would produce reports about German morale. So they would take prisoners who had recently been captured, get them in. They weren't setting in groups talking, but would get the perspective of a number of prisoners and conglomerate these into reports. So there are 14 of these that deal with morale, but they're done at regular intervals. So every few months, you'd get another report on German morale. Okay, so again, something the U.S. found very interesting. All right. So, and again, this goes on beyond the end of the war. So they're still interrogating prisoners and sending these reports until almost the end of 1945. By that point, when the war's over, a lot of the stuff that they were interrogating and sending to the U.S. Army in Europe, again, a lot of this was technical or tactical information that might be useful at a later date. But this intelligence gathering process evolves in two sort of interesting ways that I want to highlight here. One, for obvious reasons, the focus of the program changes. So after the German surrender in May of 45, understandably, the focus changed to Japan. So there's still German prisoners that are coming to Fort Hunt, but they're picking the ones who had some relationship with the Japanese military. So guys like Lieutenant General Erwisch Kessler, who was the air attaché to Tokyo, spent time at Fort Hunt, as did some other lower-ranking guys who were involved in Japanese war production and things like that, who could give some detailed testimony about what the Japanese were capable of. The other part of the focus that changes is also they were very interested in Germans who could speak to the capabilities of the Soviet Union, right? So you start getting prisoners like Major General Heinrich Aschenbrenner, who could speak to German personnel who had fought the Soviets in the East, or Major General Walter Vero, who could speak to the road networks. He was an engineering corps general officer. So these guys, I mean, Vero goes so far, he writes several extensive reports about the road networks, the buildings, the bridges, river crossings, all kinds of things in the Soviet Union. So clearly the U.S. interest is not only in defeating Japan, but also in potentially understanding as much as they could about the Red Army as well. So Vero also demonstrates a second sort of evolution of this program, which was the shift also begins to occur when they care less and less about directly interrogating or eavesdropping on prisoners. And the U.S. has a great deal more interest in actually having prisoners come to Fort Hunt and do research in their own captured documents and then writing extensive reports about that, right? So they don't officially do this, but they're almost merging the activities of the Military Intelligence Research Section and MISY, but in this case they're taking prisoners of war and having them look at their own captured documents and write reports. And this extends beyond Fort Hunt. There's another program at Camp Ritchie that does the similar kind of thing. And the folks that are left over after, I mean, they don't finally ship all the prisoners out until June or July of 1946, but the folks that were left behind by that point were fairly high-profile folks like Reinhard Galen, who was still here, and the U.S. is gathering intelligence and about the Soviet Union for the most part, but other kinds of things from Galen, right? So the trick here with this is just because you gather a lot of information and just because it was sent to the Army in Europe doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. Army did anything with it, right? So that's stage two, which is not part of this paper, sorry, to be continued, leave you hanging. The trick with that is there is some work that's been done in this regard, but even that, there are, So there are already, so one side note, the National Park Service had interviewed something like 73 of the men who had worked as interrogators at Fort Hunt, which if you're interested, they've actually posted on their website, so you can actually pull the transcripts down and look at them. One of these guys claims that he actually was a monitor who listened in from the switchboard to the prisoners talking in their rooms, and that he uncovered information about the German slave labor camp at Peenemünde who built the V-2 rockets that the British subsequently bombed, right? So he's sort of claiming credit for this. He said, well, I unearthed this. Well, British claim the same thing, that they heard the very same things at their camps in Britain, that that's where they got the information. So, again, it's hard to tell sometimes where this information had come from. And there's been some other scholarship on sort of all the war crimes that were admitted to into American and British microphones as well. So again, very interesting, fascinating reading, but at the end of the day, the British did absolutely nothing with this because they didn't want to divulge how they'd gotten this information. So again, collected a large body of information, but didn't do anything with it. So anyway, the next step with this is to try to wade through 100,000 more pages to try to figure out where this went. Perhaps I can find another route. But also to try to pair this up with what the U.S. Army ETO is doing and to try to marry up what the U.S. Army actually did with it. But this stuff is actually what Fort Hunt thought was useful enough to send to Europe and say, this is stuff you should pay attention to. So, again, at least it speaks to the value that they placed at that time on prisoners of war and the extent to which they went to obtain that information, because it was a pretty large endeavor, right, to house these guys for 3 and 4 years, all the expense of hiding microphones and training personnel and that kind of thing. So the U.S. at least placed a high value on it, whether they ultimately did a lot with it or not. So anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. So I know we have a break coming up, but I still invite questions for our three panelists.
Well, that's a very good question. For some reason, the Confederates thought it was more valuable to target immigrants. You know, Braxton Bragg, when he was in early 64, I think he initiated this whole process, from what I understand it. And he specifically said that the Germans, the Irish, and everybody else may be more fit targets for recruiting for the Confederate Army. So I don't think he gave an explanation as to why, other than this perception among the Confederates that these are kind of like the Hessians. You know, they're being hired. They don't really have their heart in the Union war effort and all that kind of stuff. And they're weak, and we can manipulate them, and we can encourage them to do that. And, gosh, I never heard that story about the fake priest. That's an interesting little thing. and, you know, my impression is that it worked mostly because of the bad conditions, the pressure, and the belief that this is, let's save myself and get out of here and not worry about the consequences. Now, that brings up to me the interesting question. There were thousands more people, Union soldiers trying to survive at Andersonville, who didn't do this. And even the Fort Donelson prisoners, of course, apparently just a pretty small minority, I think, my guess would be, of them took the oath of allegiance to get out of prison and chose that course. The vast majority didn't. So it's an interesting question of persistence on the part of soldiers, despite difficulties and all that kind of stuff, resisting inducements. My guess is the people who took that course of action had more wavering devotion to the cause to begin with. And, you know, there's always a certain percentage of men in every army who place other things other than the cause as their top priority. And I guess these are the people who that sort of thing works on. Captain Jordan's a different story. He's an officer to begin with. And most of these other guys seem to have been enlisted men, from what I can tell. And Jordan was a very good company commander for a long time. That's a good case study of someone who was undone, I think, by the pressure of this continuous campaigning throughout the Atlanta campaign, and just decided to do what other Confederate enlisted men were certainly doing during the Atlanta campaign, taking an opportunity to skip off to the enemy side in the night while on picket duty. The interesting thing is he's an officer doing it. That probably doesn't answer your question, but it's about all that I can do. The problem, as you well know, is we don't have any letters or diaries from these characters. So we don't know their motivation. We can only guess at it or surmise and that kind of stuff. Thank you.
Marcel?
That's a great question. So I actually had this conversation with Sunken Knights at a conference last December. So he studied it more than I have, and so I have a lot of respect for his work. At Fort Hunt, there's some indication that the prisoners suspected, at least some of them did. I would agree with him that I think the overwhelming majority of prisoners did not, because they do cough up some really candid stuff on all kinds of topics. But there was a couple interesting exchanges. I mean, at one point they put Kessler and Ashenbrenner in the same room, and these two were like, at times they're talking, and then suddenly they go really, really quiet. And then it comes back again. And it can't be that they're just like walking around the room, right? At other times, they make comments that even one of the guys that's monitoring the conversation writes on the thing, are these two playing with us? Because they made a comment about how they should learn Russian because that's the language of the future. They can't believe that. They're both smarter than that. So you'd think that at least these two, whether they actually, you know, who knows? I mean,
As Neitzel points out, I mean, the German army had given them all instructions that at least the British did it. So they'd been forewarned that the British would put microphones in light fixtures and whatnot. So, again, for the most part, I don't think they did. But there are a few cases when I suspect maybe a few of them might have had some inkling.
Yeah.
Paul?
Right.
My question is for Derek, but it's really kind of open to anybody that's looking for a project. The Office of Naval Intelligence in the 1950s continues to interrogate former German prisoners of war, but they're interrogating ones that were coming back from the Soviet Union in the mid-1950s. And they're asking them about what they saw of the Soviet industrial infrastructure plans for a potential third world war. Have you done any work with that? Is that somewhere that you think you might branch into?
I have not done any work with that. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting stuff. I mean, you know, that's was it Kevin Suter that published in the Journal of Military History about how the U.S. Army had rewritten their tank doctrine based on what the German POWs had told them. So, I mean, that would be fascinating stuff to look at. So,
Man?
Oh, like the MISX program?
Yeah.
So what they did, so first of all, they would try to train servicemen before they went what they could do in case they were captured. Again, they had a whole technology section that devised these board games and radios and things that they could hide, and they would send them in food kits so the prisoners would get them, and then they were tipped off that, like, you know, this baseball is a radio, don't play catch with it, you know. But they were also trying to organize, again, part of these things were also trying to get the maps and other kinds of things to try to help them escape. So it's all about first evasion so they could, you know, not be captured in the first place, and then if they were, how they could escape and get back to Allied lines. So, again, the details are a little sketchier with that program because very little of it's survived. But that's the bulk of what they're trying to do is teach them how not to get caught and aid them if they did through technology and other means.
Lorian?
So I'm going to do another one of my multiple questions all at once that will overwhelm you and render you, confused. But my question is for Mr. Farrell. Two questions. So if we're thinking about prisoners and their place in these, I'll stay in that one. So if we're thinking about the role of prisoners at shedding light on the expansion of state power and the assertion of state sovereignty. So when we're dealing with prisoners, this is an area where there's been an evolution of customs of war and laws of war on an international level that the participants are very anxious to assert their place in this tradition of Western civilized war. Mm-hmm. And show that their policies fit with that. They're also very concerned, as I discussed earlier, with claiming a narrative of civilization. So if we're thinking about assertion of state power, how do you think that international expectations and pressures and cultural pressures about civilization would interact with ideas of power? Does that question make sense?
Well, sort of. It's kind of like why the Lieber Code is designed in the first place. It kind of gives moral cover to the United States to kind of do what they need to do to win the war. So it's kind of like how Mark Grimsley put it. The document really is not as limiting as it may, appear to be. It actually allows the United States quite a substantial latitude in fighting the war in the way that they need to, while kind of giving it the kind of an air of, like you put, like, civilization. It's within Western tradition. It kind of gives the facade that it's limiting. Does that answer kind of make sense?
Ma'am, first.
To express themselves, and added to that, lack of supplies.
you guys want to reply, or
can I have a clarification of the question?
Can you say explain a little bit more?
About supplies? I'm sorry. I guess I didn't.
You want to speak right to that?
Well, actually, it hasn't come up at all today, but one of the huge topics is it costs a lot of money to keep prisoners from war alive. And nations at war don't have a lot of resources. And so, Dr. Hess, you're kind of on the cusp of how do we cut down on our costs? And their answer was, let's let some of them go who's being nice. Derek is like, well, it's going to cost a lot of money to maintain them, but maybe they'll tell us things that we want to know and we'll do nothing with it. The dominant answer to this dilemma, though, is make them work really hard and terrible jobs. And that's the reality of, I guess, 80% of prisoners of war in the 20th century. Is they end up as slave laborers, not as people being recorded or people playing crafty tricks on, recruiting boards. So, I don't know, is that really what you were
saying? I think that probably was more likely to be in later wars than Civil War.
No, that's about World War I and World War II. Prisoners of war are recognized as of economic value, and they're exploited.
Yeah, you want to speak right to that? I see your hand up.
Yeah, along the lines of what he's saying and Daniel's talk, it seems like the conditions in those Confederate prisons were really reflective of the effects of the war on the Southern economy. You know, they just didn't have the resources.
Michael, you had your hand up too? Yes. Can you speak up a little bit? Sorry.
Very harsh there because he had just been a POW and then he went back to Sherman and
Anybody want to reply to some of the comments?
The more I think about the Civil War, the more I think it is, we need to understand that it was, the phrase an improvised war needs to be taken very seriously. That an awful lot of what we interpret as, quote, lack of resources is just poor allocation of available resources. And I think that maybe we kind of should reorient ourselves to understanding that no matter how well military systems worked north and south in the Civil War, they still didn't work as well as we would want them to or expect them to. And so an awful lot of what might be seen as deliberate was in reality not at all. And I think the Confederate systems tended to work far less well than the Union systems to explain an awful lot of stuff that could be going on.
I just let me add to that one of the observations that I had from all three papers here, and I'm not sure what your reaction is to that, and also in the audience, is that we're talking in that period, you know, my period, late 18th century and the 19th century, about expanding control by the state over individuals. By the 20th century, we're supposedly reaching that age of totalitarianism where the state has total control over you as an individual. And especially what Derek is saying and Earl was saying and what I found too is like we find all these examples of individuals gaming the system, getting around, having a lot of room for maneuver, and actually denying a lot of, and Daniel was talking to them about, you know, too, denying the state that total control that the state wanted. Supposedly, I don't know, but I mean that's something that I was wondering about. And Derek, I was thinking like some of those German officers probably told stories to make themselves more valuable to the Americans. So when I talk about the Soviets, maybe they want me, you know, and see myself as more valuable because that might be the next enemy. Over the Earl, of course, you know we have all these examples of prisoners switching sides multiple times. And we see that in early modern Europe. And in early modern Europe, we always explained it away by saying, well, yeah, of course, mercenary armies, you know, they switch sides, you know, whoever pays and, you know, all of that. But then you're dealing with the 19th century, you know, supposedly the age of nationalism and believing in a cause and ideology, and they're doing the same thing. So that's at least an observation, I think, that I see here, and a little bit of a corrective to our understanding of a ever-increasing, more powerful state as we move from the 17th into the 18th into the 19th and 20th century. One last question, sorry.
Earl, what you just said, do you think it's more of a power structure thing, or is it economic, or is it the South being less able to?
To a degree, it's both, but I'm more and more and more convinced that the South failed because it didn't know how to use the resources it did on many, many different levels. It had a railroad system, but that railroad system, for example, completely failed to support the Confederate war effort, in part because the South did not have the industrial resources to replace rolling stock, and also because the Confederate government made one bad decision after another about how to use railroad systems. And I don't mean to... Maybe I shouldn't say this, but let's think of the South as a third world country and the Confederacy as a third world country. If that old concept means anything anymore in the year 2017, a country where the existing systems, political, economic, military, simply don't work very well. And it's because of a lot of different reasons, I think. It's fascinating to me to read, for example, the strategic projections and plans of people like P.G.D. Beauregard, that were just fantasy. They're just sheer fantasy. Beauregard thought, all we need to do is gather all Confederate armies in one place, put me in charge of it, and I'll be on the banks of the Ohio River and into Illinois tomorrow. Forgetting, of course, that maybe the federal armies might have something to say about that. And, you know, it's the Confederates just had a tendency to kind of think that, okay, elan and enthusiasm is all you need to win a war. And it was a cruel misconception, a self-deception on their part.
I want to just throw in one specific to conclude related to that. So let's take the Confederate prison system. They never put one single person in charge of the system. Yeah. And the two men who were in charge, they didn't know which prisons they were over.
Exactly. Some people within the Confederacy recognized it was a problem, but Richmond never solved that organizational problem. So I think that kind of addresses that issue. If we're talking about the expansion of the state, there's still a lot of both the Union and the Confederate states that are not modern.
Yeah.
We can continue the rest of the conversation over the break. We'll be back right at 5...